Sorry, I'm Andres Guadalmus, and I think we're all going to introduce each other. So Andres Guadalmus, I'm a senior lecturer in intellectual property law at the University of Sussex.
Hi, I'm Luis Carlos. I come from Venezuela. I'm a journalist. In the morning, I'm in the radio every day. So the rest of the day, I'm a cyber activist. I work in the internet, and I love internet.
My name is Solana. I am the editor of Mozilla's Internet Health Report, and I'm from Denmark and Puerto Rico.
I am Manuel Beltrán. I am an artist and activist. I come from the social movements of the Indignados in Spain and Gezi Park in Turkey. And currently, I work as an artist in the Institute of Human Obsolescence. And also, I'm the initiator of the Data Workers Union.
So, first, as you have heard, Renata Avila cannot be with us. She brought us all together, which is probably one of the reasons why we're all Spanish speakers and we're tempted to conduct this in Spanish to begin with. But we wanted to start with a definition of what is digital colonialism. Renata has actually written quite a lot on this subject. So to keep her presence with us today, I wanted to read you what she defines as digital colonialism. She says, digital colonialism is the new deployment of a quasi-imperial power over a vast number of people without their explicit consent, manifested in rules, designs, languages, cultures, and belief systems by a vastly dominant power. And when asked, isn't colonialism a little bit strong? It's a strong word. It has very negative, strong connotations. She says, it is serious. The foundations of freedom and democracy are at stake when centralized global agents have the power to monitor, process, and mediate all user communications. So that is sort of the starting point of our conversation. As you can see, I have an Apple computer, I use Google, I use Facebook, I live in the United Kingdom, I'm Costa Rican, but all of these tools are pervasive. I think that one of the, before we're called on any hypocrisy, that we are actually using these tools and there's a reason why we're using them. Sometimes there is no alternative. So I think Solana was going to start with a few comments and then we'll just have continue with the conversation and then we'll pass everything to you for questions.
Okay? Yeah, I think this idea of digital colonization, people are saying, well, Facebook and Google don't think of themselves as colonializers. It's not their intention to colonize. Is this really a helpful term for talking about these things? And I think from the country where I come from, in Puerto Rico, is also not a colony in official terms, but in practical terms, it is a colony of the United States. And I think when I think of digital colonialization, I don't think it really matters so much what we call it. The thing that you want to highlight is that there's a relationship that's unfair, that's exploitative or feels exploitative to some extent, regardless of what the intention is or not. And I think more and more people are saying there's something wrong in the power relationship between the big technology companies and the way that technology is rolled out all over the world, especially in the global south, which has a very current recent memory of colonization or is still living the experience of colonization in other aspects of their economies and politics and dealings with imperialism.
Yeah, well, I think that we have two problems with this. First, in our countries, this is not a discussion. So to us, it's like a future worry, you know? We are worrying in the past, thinking what's going on with this. The second is that we have other actors. It's not only the big governments, so it's not only the big companies. It's also the relation that other bad governments has. By example, in Venezuela, it's not only the problem that with Gmail or Facebook is China and Russia and Syria and Iran sharing technologies and know-how with our government. So if we are thinking about big data and big companies, maybe we also need to think with big data and our government, because it's a close actor to us. Maybe if you told a person in Venezuela, oh, Facebook is collecting your data. Well, Facebook is too far. Mark Zuckerberg is not my friend. But the police is my neighbor. The government is in this city and is controlling me. So we need to deal with a lot of layers of afraid, a lot of layers of no control. And to us, at the end, it's a conversation about power. Who has the power and why? And how is working with us?
Yeah, I think it's we're discussing that we somehow lack like a collective vision in how to tackle these issues. If we should have like governments protecting us, or we might just reproduce the same mistake of letting a different government take over this. But I wanted to pinpoint for a second also how the logic behind the desire of these companies to reach new territories. So, for example, with projects like Free Basics to provide internet to places that haven't been datafied yet, is not that they are doing humanitarian technology, bringing so-called free gated internet to a country, but rather they just find a new ground from which to exploit the data that users of the internet will be producing in that place. And to kind of think ahead of a problem that it's somehow going to increase dramatically in dimensions, think for a moment that the current business models around big data rely mostly in the selling of advertisement. And we are discussing all the time how our data is being used for advertisement. But what is actually happening in a period of 2 to 5 years is that the data that we are producing is being used to train artificial intelligence. So we are going to see a shift in how the big tech companies are going to jump from providing these so-called free services to provide AI services to replace healthcare, to replace transportation, to replace education. And if Facebook or Google or Amazon or any other big tech company will arrive to a country that has a broken economy and say, hey, look, we can provide you these education services because you don't have budget to have like a public education, but we can provide it for you, saving a lot of cost, being much more efficient, or in the case of healthcare, it might be a service on which the people goes less to the hospital because they have apps in their phones that track their health status, so they don't go that often to the hospital and they save money. And this might reach to a new whole level on which what we are discussing now as digital colonialism in the context of internet infrastructure or domain names or the kind of existing infrastructure is going to jump outside of what we consider the net and start to replace more and more aspects of what we used to call public infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. The infrastructure problem is perhaps one of the reasons why you have this. And this is one of it's actually what attracted me to this debate. As I was saying, I've been specializing in intellectual property. I do boring copyright in artificial intelligence and things like that. But what has been bringing me to this debate is actually the infrastructural inequality that is built into the system. And just by looking at the network, how the network was created, the internet is a complex system, and as such, any starting advantage that you had in infrastructure is built into the system. So for many years, you could not connect physically. The packets that went from one country to the other had to go through the United States. This has been getting a little bit better, but a lot of the funding, a lot of the companies that started the internet as we know it, were centralized in Europe and in the United States. Now, this inequality has resulted in services that are not catered for us, that we heard, for example, free services and all of these free basics schemes that are presented in mobile companies that are offering free services like WhatsApp and all these companies that are not from developing countries are being offered for free, and that is in detriment of potentially other companies that could rise that provide the same services locally. So this is a problem of infrastructure.
I think and it's not just a problem of lack of competition and local innovation. It's also the case that sometimes the privacy protections or other considerations you would have for a local population in the country of origin, as soon as you're in Africa or in Latin America or somewhere where you have less concern for the local population, there are different rules that apply and different forms of exploitation that take place, or experimentation. I mean, we see lots of experimentation with biometrics in ways that would not happen in California or in Denmark or the United States, and other kinds of data collection where the government may or may not either know that it's happening or care that it's happening or might be complicit in the collection of data. And so you have these consumer-facing technologies like Facebook or WhatsApp, but you also have a lot of technology companies that are providing services to governments. Like you were saying, there's the surveillance technologies that are used by police and different state apparatuses. But there's also smart city technology, lots and lots of contracts that are being signed all over the global south with technology companies for smart light bulbs and cameras and different things to make the cities more efficient. And it feels like nobody is aware right now that there's a responsibility of both the governments and the citizenship and civil society to think of alternatives and to ask the question, is this really created with the citizens' best interest in mind? And, you know, can that be done from far away? Does Facebook have the same protections for hate speech or fake news in Ghana or in Costa Rica as it does in the United States or in Germany? Mm-hmm. Definitely not. Do they in Myanmar? Definitely not. It's not possible for these companies to pay the same amount of care and attention to the communities that they service. So what is the solution? What are the public-private partnerships that need to be created? What are the local alternatives that need to be stimulated? How do we get past that barrier and develop an internet ecology that's more healthy for the world?
Sure, because this is not a problem about not developed country. It's not a problem for poor countries. It's not a problem of far, far away. Maybe these poor countries are the experiment. Maybe these poor countries are in the future, because without democracy or with democracy in crisis, maybe we are seeing these experiments or these issues before other countries. By example, if it's the same rule to every country, so Facebook is erasing, it's blocking the anti-terror, the terrorist message, so it's a consensus, not terrorist in Facebook. All right. But in my country, maybe I consider a terrorist because I'm against government. Even in Colombia, terrorism is another thing. Maybe in Spain, in this new context, there is a problem with the government and terrorizes other people. And United States, maybe you think, no, you think it's a strong democracy, but Trump, it's like an elephant in a, you know, in a crystal shop. So if tomorrow, what's terrorism in the United States? So the same rule, it's complicated to apply in a lot of countries. And it's not the same internet that we knew a lot of years ago, where the users, we build our rules and we learn together and we were walking together. In this moment, it's a lot of people decided by us, and that's a lot of problem, a new frontier. So by that, I think that we need to discuss all the time in every part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on this topic of terrorism and censorship rules, for example, I know of the case of Turkey, for example, on which the Erdogan regime posed this question: if Facebook wants to be in Turkey, It has to apply the censorship rules to, for example, there cannot be any image of Abdullah Öcalan. He's the only person alive or dead that is not allowed to be posted an image on Facebook. You cannot post any image of a Turkish flag being burned or any references to the PKK, to the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And actually, Turkey managed to force Facebook to implement this censorship, that it becomes paradoxical when we speak about other governments protecting their citizens from data extraction, political manipulation, or so on, it fails. But when actually a strong regime like Erdogan's regime in Turkey pushes Facebook to the limit of saying, if you want to be in Turkey, you have to apply these rules, then they comply. Which poses the question, like, actually nation states can have the power to stop these platforms from operating in the way they want, and they can also force them to apply the rules. The problem is that autocratic regimes have the will to do so, and the so-called democratic states do not really have either a vocabulary or a policy or a position to actually establish the limits of how far companies like Facebook can reach into shaping not just how we interact with each other, but what kind of images or propaganda are we allowed to share on a social network. Mm.
If I could say something positive, would be that as much as we also complain about these technologies, these are also technologies that have provided the infrastructure for an enormous amount of positive activity, for social movements, for speaking against repressive governments, that there's that dynamic as well, that sometimes your enemies are also your friends. I mean, they're frenemies, I think, is the term. But sometimes your adversaries, which could be the government or could be the technology companies, can also be your allies. In the same way that we want governments to make regulations that make the companies behave better, in other contexts, the governments are the adversaries who maybe are too eager to censor or too eager to survey. Another thing, I think, in economic terms, yes, there's a lot of Facebook and WhatsApp, and a lot of these resources and data is creating earnings on the other side of the globe. But people are also using WhatsApp and Facebook and all kinds of other big technology companies to make their own income, to have their own small businesses, to make their own WhatsApp stores. And sometimes, you know, changing the way that technology was designed to be used and adapting it to their own needs. So there's a lot of creativity and innovation, I think, in terms of money making and communication that isn't always given as much credit as it deserves, I think. And sometimes it even causes the technology companies to think differently about what their business models are in different parts of the world. And it's that kind of innovation that you think, okay, well, there are ways to turn this into something different or to create alternatives if we can level the playing field, if we can create more competitive and innovative spaces for things to coexist.
Fantastic. Brings us to the positive side, I guess. What are the solutions? I think that we admit that there is a problem. There are positives, but there is a problem. What should we do? Should we rely on self-regulation, benign venture capitalist Elon Musk and Bitcoins to take us out of the problem, or are there any other solutions? I think we've been hinting at them. Yeah,
well, I was thinking that in this question, in this problem, maybe to a lot of users in my country, a lot of Latin American countries, we are not feeling under menace by these companies. In fact, it's our opportunity to build a new way to be citizen. By example, maybe we lose democracy in Venezuela, but in Twitter and Facebook, in these digital spaces, we are rebuilding again, and we are discovering the deliberative democracy. We are discovering how to discuss. We are discovering how to make new consensus, and it's a huge you know, like phenomenon, because in our countries there is not a difference between rich and poor, because a lot of people are connected, a lot of people are in internet, so a lot of poor people can access to more information in internet than in other media, because we don't have other medias. So you can say, oh, well, in fact, Facebook is collecting your data and they are playing you a lot of rules. But people are thinking, no, I'm winning with this. I'm winning a lot of things. Are we winning relationships? Are we winning more works and jobs? Are we winning knowledge? So this is a big contradiction, because it's like, oh, well, welcome to the internet. The internet is a beautiful place, but also it's a health, you know, so you need to move in two layers all the time. It's not a contradiction, it's real life. You're discovering the real life. That's amazing about the internet.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, completely. Like, I am the first one who in Indignados in 2011 experienced the power of social media. And I think back then I was even very idealistic about the power of Facebook and Twitter to bring forward the revolution. Just later we realize of the problems emerging with that belief too. But it's undeniable that these platforms also produce a lot of benefits till the point on which we are highly dependent, as you started mentioning how we depend on Apple computers, Gmail, and so on. But if we are so dependent on these platforms as we are dependent in drinking water or electricity, then perhaps we could think in how to transform these things into public infrastructure that is not controlled by these private, in many cases foreign actors, but how to actually regain citizen control. And with citizen control, I'm not speaking about the idea of nationalizing Facebook or nationalizing big tech companies and taking them out from the private sector into a nation state control. We have a quite clear example of what happens in China that is completely independent from this US imperialist big tech, but they are created their own surveillance monster. And if you look into things like the social credit system, it becomes very clear how the expansion of these technologies reaches until the point that becomes a tool of massive control of a society. So what can we do about it? We have a lot of benefits. I'm not saying that we should be against collecting data. Data can be very useful if we are in control of the data that we are producing. And I put the emphasis is the data that we are producing. It's not that Facebook is just building all of this content out of the blue, but we are the ones providing the content. So how are we going to deal with this data that is serving these services, that is shaping and training the artificial intelligence that will end up providing this healthcare system, this education system, and so that we are training. Since we are training the services that are going to replace us, actually, that are going to automate many forms of work that we are currently doing, that is going to push us to be even more dependent of these platforms. My personal vision on this is if the production of data has so much weight in this creation of AI, we should regain collective ownership of this production of data and not let any private actor or nation state actor be in control of this. But perhaps the role of governments could be to make sure that the right of the ownership of data remains with the citizens and that no external private or nation state company can actually go and extract this data from us.
Should we open up to?
Yeah, it's perfect timing for opening for questions, I guess. Do we have any other, or just this?
No, so I'm just trying to, if you have a question, raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you.
This time.
Oh, okay, great.
Thank you very much for your conversation. Really interesting stuff. I think the big companies certainly are less interested in the nation state. So this kind of colonization idea, I think, is quite close. But on the other hand, I think they are looking much broader than this. And we seem to have this problem that the civil society is not maybe growing to an extent that it should. So in many states, they are actually shrinking, which means that you have state, media, and business collaboration on a much larger scale than on a national level. Now, a question to you would be, what kind of accountability could we suggest? I mean, how can we deal with this? Because this, the national border is not relevant, so national regulation will not do it. The UN, now, well, that would be an interesting take, but I think we are not maybe hugely optimistic on them being able to propose something good there. So what kind of accountability would be helpful to bring the power back to the user?
I think you would have to do several things at once. I would say that national regulation does make a difference, and that national policies do make a difference. I think laws like the one that have been passed in the European Union for privacy protection, where a number of countries or a trade organization get together and set some ground rules, at least is a start for holding companies accountable or governments accountable. I mean, none of these systems are perfect, just as we know with human rights law or intellectual property laws, that it's really difficult with these things. But I think that the national and local decisions on these topics really make a difference. I mean, even in the United States, where net neutrality has been shut down, you have individual states that are trying to enforce net neutrality and trying to do things above and beyond what the governments are trying to shoot down. And then at the other side, sorry, the way that the companies themselves disclose what they aim to do to protect privacy, I think, is a big thing. Ranking Digital Rights just published a new report where they look at what are the ways that telecom companies and technology companies disclose how they treat people's data and what their attitude is to human rights and what their attitude is to privacy protections, and encouraging companies to be more open and more clear about what happens to the data and what they think, I think, is also a good start to help consumers to hold companies accountable and to try and make it something that is a competitive advantage, that good behavior towards your users would be a competitive advantage.
Well, I think that for accountability, transparency is important. I love when Twitter says at the end of the year, well, this government sent us 100 petition to know the IP address or the name of these users in this list, and we say no. So it's transparency about the petitions, it's transparency about the defense of this social network with their user. But I need the same with the other industry. I need the same not only with the big state, I need the same with the competition, because we revealed a lot of months ago that our government are buying data to other private sector. So maybe Twitter is defending us against the government, some of the bad government, but they are selling data to companies. So if we cheap our data, our government can buy it. So we need more transparency in the order of more accountability.
Just to finish that, I think regulation is really it can be good for every GDPR, which I think it's probably beneficial. We get a SESTA FOSTA in the United States, which is going to have nefarious effects. We are under discussion for this horrible copyright directive that is going to create a link right that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, and it could decimate media in Europe. So we have a problem of completely clueless regulators sometimes that have no idea. If you saw the Zuckerberg Congress, the hearing, it was laughable sometimes, the level of knowledge of some of the senators and the regulators. So we regulation is good, but it has to be paired with knowledge, and I think that's the role of civil society, of academics and other people to actually provide that. I think society itself, communities can be organized as well, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to if I can add something to the thanks for the question. I was actually just thinking in the previous hearing on which Twitter, Google, and Facebook were giving testimony in the Senate and to the intelligence community about the so-called Russian meddling on the elections. And at that point, it became really clear that we were discussing about Facebook, Twitter, and Google being companies that are at the front line of protecting the US interests. Mm-hmm. It was a conversation on the realm of protecting the US from foreign influence, while the US is doing foreign influence everywhere. But that's something that, because it's actually a nation state controlling somehow these companies, or controlling that at least Facebook serves the national interest of the US, that in the way that we have now all of this discussion on the protection from elections meddling, it's on this context of those are US companies that must protect mm-hmm. the so-called US democracy. And on your point on transcending borders, you know, or we discussed before how GDPR just is in a way also pushing for this exodus of big tech companies, that now Facebook decided to withdraw their Irish headquarters, and everyone's like, oh, okay, so GDPR is not going to apply to them. I think of one example of what I perhaps see as the first project that the whole of humankind built together, that I think it's Linux. The kernel of Linux is a project on which all of us have been coding stuff, and you can think about it as we are all producing data. Why don't we take some lessons of how this project was being done, transcending borders, to build something collectively that benefits the commons, benefits, belongs, and is owned by the commons? Perhaps we can follow or learn lessons from this methodology of free software in how to approach these questions of big data. The kernel of Linux does not fall under the control of any nation state or any legal regulation, but it's a kind of stateless project. So we have, I think, already very strong and very rooted and discussed examples on how we can actually build a worldwide project such as Linux in a way that does not bring all of these problematic dynamics of imperialism, colonialism, and so on.
Just questions.
Yes, thanks. That was very interesting what you said. I work for a German NGO network on environmental and development issues, so we've just started to get into this conversation as well. And I think what you mentioned about how companies control the health and education sector in the future, we already see this with Facebook supplying African schools with laptops. Of course, the apps are pre-installed. And what I find so troubling is that UN organizations and countries in the global north are very much supporting this development, because for them that's part of their development strategy. So one of my questions would be, what can we do about this, lobbying our governments in the global north? Another question is, I wanted to highlight another layer of colonialism that I find isn't really present in the tech community, which is, it's not just about virtual, it's also about the reality of where our products come from, and all the resource extraction, of course, is deeply rooted in post-colonialism and exploitation structures. Are you also in touch with movements that are demonstrating against this, or that are trying to find out how we can use resources more efficiently and go about this structure? And maybe my third question on the positive impacts, because a lot of people have been talking about the possibilities of blockchains for new sort of development chances in all over the world, where you are independent of state structures or financial institutions to build your own companies, or to have a new identity and all that, or that that your property can be claimed without states interfering. Are you at all involved in this? I'm trying to figure out if there's something about it, or if it's just the blockchain people trying to promote their products.
Okay, so this is a hot button issue. A lot of people have something to say, but let's try and keep it really brief so our panelists can also respond quickly, and we can make it more inclusive. Thank you.
The Microsoft to the other guy is what was the hand, so
okay, you want to take all and then you come. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, my name is Karim. We founded coinsense.org. We have realized before it was the issue of colonializing the resources, the people, the natural resources. So we could solve this today with building new currencies to access to the resources. This is not an issue. But we are moving now in colonializing the markets. It means I colonialize the user interface and the access to the markets. It means at the end we need solutions which make the customer owning the companies who have control to the company. And we're trying to solve this by saying, okay, we normally companies ask for profit, and this is the promise, I deliver a value for the customer. And we say, okay, for the profit, the customer gets shares in the company. So in long term, it's the market or the people who depend from the solution which get control. Do you know people who are working on this? Or so the idea to make customer the owner of companies.
Thank you.
The first question of the lady. We need to connect a lot of people. A lot of people are not yet in the internet. So how we can connect? Well, we need a business model plan, or we need government with investment. But in this case, we only have these options with Facebook and I don't know what. That's a problem because I think by social use of technology, like Solana said before, people are taking these tools and they're going to create whatever they want. Maybe we are worried about the first step inside Facebook, that only internet is Facebook because Facebook gave you the connection. But maybe people can be free, more free than that we have, that we think, more free that we think. Because once you discover all this environment, this new environment, you can create different things. I say this because I received internet in my public school in, I don't know, maybe 1994. So a lot of years ago, I was a little child with internet in a small town in third world town. So it can change life if you give the first touch to the internet. So I think that it could be an opportunity, a way. But we need the criticize too. Mm-hmm. And second was the blockchain. My government, if you look in the news, my government in Venezuela are offering bitcoins to the people, but it's not bitcoins, are petro coins. It's a bitcoin based in petroleum. So it's a scam, it's fake. They are robbing people, they are making a huge corruption movement. But they are using your language, they are using this net language to sell that offer. So it's a big scam and it's not working. Why? Because you need an independent, decentralized system. Mm-hmm. And in this case, these countries like Venezuela are using the opposite. They are using a system centralized, based in petroleum, so it's not trust, it's oil. So it's a commodity. At the end, it's a commodity. It's not a blockchain. It's the old economy using the new language. So that's a big problem.
I think what northern governments should be advising or thinking about when they're trying to push for a development that includes internet technology is for more stakeholders to be at the table. I see so many technology discussions where you don't have local civil society present, and you don't have in the development of these technologies, whether it's biometrics or data collection, or you don't have civil society actors present who can hold governments accountable and who can hold the companies accountable and say no. So, I mean, we need a whole different way of designing technology for large population groups in other parts of the world and insisting that there be local participants at the very least, I think, is something that northern governments can help create awareness about. The other thing, I think, is about infrastructure. We've seen, in the vein of decentralization, a lot of really wonderful decentralized local community networks where communities in rural parts of the world are creating internet access where it's not profitable for large internet companies. So things like handing over spectrum wide spectrum, television spectrum, and giving it to communities and creating laws whereby civil society and local communities can gain control of spectrum and create cell phone networks that work for themselves and that are not created with a profit incentive, but to solve local communication issues is a huge thing and is something that you can push for internationally in international forums and also in terms of regulation. With blockchain, I think many people are stuck on thinking about currency, when actually some of the more exciting uses of blockchain technology will also be related to infrastructure and how we move information and how we're able to create transactions that are not just about money, but exchanging other goods and services. And that's where the technology itself is, in theory, could be neutral and could be used for other things. It could be an enabler of all kinds of new innovation and technology. It can be harnessed in different ways. It can be used to create decentralized systems, decentralized internets. and so I think, yes, there's a certain amount of hype, but it could be used and harnessed for many different things. And with things like artificial intelligence, It's a foreign policy objective of the United States and of many other countries to be strong in these areas. I think we can't forget that these same companies are also the ones, and research organizations are the same ones that are providing information to our militaries, not just in terms of surveillance technology, but also facial recognition systems that can be used to target people with guns. so you can shoot the right faces from a distance. So these technologies are also weaponized in different ways that we're not thinking about so much in these spaces. And so that's another angle on the colonization.
Okay, so we have 15 minutes to wrap up this session. There's room for two more questions, and then I'll take you back to the moderator to have closing one. I'll take one here, and then I'll take you there. Any other part? Can we? Okay. And one more. Okay, so three questions. The rest of it, we can take it on the side and have a conversation.
Thank you. So something that I've been thinking about, and I appreciate folks up here bringing to the fore, is this idea that the tech space can be complicit and is actually complicit in bringing what I term in my work just a neocolonial practice into a lot of spaces. And I really appreciate the question about development because I also work in that space as well. And I wanted to caveat with that because I want to also make sure folks know that I'm also complicit in this work, right? So, but my question is, how do folks in this room contend with the fact that a lot of these technologies that we think about possibly being democratic are sometimes tested on the bodies that are most marginalized, and especially thinking about biometric technologies and the collection of folks who are migrants, data across borders. And the reason I ask this is because I often use the same point that there should be stakeholders at the table when these things are being developed and used in practice, but there's no bringing stakeholders to the table when it comes to people moving across borders, right? And I want to ask this question in this room because we are in the EU, and the EU has this discourse that is right. Human rights laws doesn't exist. I'm a lawyer, is why I say this. But how do we have this discourse about human rights and the right to be forgotten, and folks who are moving across these borders that are in the most marginalized spaces have linkages to past colonial projects are then continued even in this space to be the sites of military testing and technology. They are the sites in which the states rely on to exploit new practice, new technology, new development. And that's not just, we keep on pointing back to the United States. The EU does this too. How do we contend with that? How do we contend with marginalized people being the sites of how we develop technology?
Thank you. So we take all three questions, and then you please take note of it, and then we come back to you.
Hi, thanks for everything you said. I just had one question, because you were focusing mostly on the user side of things and how people use technology and how they should own their own data and everything. But I was wondering if you had any thoughts on digital colonialism, as in the workforce that is digitally exploited for example, content moderation or translation or programming. That's obviously kind of the backbone of all these internationally operating companies.
Then the last question, and we come back to you. Was it you? Okay. Let's make it brief.
Thanks for your thoughts about colonialization and how it does not create diverse ecosystems, and I'd agree on that. And what came to my mind is that we are used to call things like Facebook and Twitter platforms, but to me that's not a platform. A platform is something you provide a foundation where you build your own ideas and solution upon. And that's not what Facebook and Twitter do. They provide a service which they define and they implement, and you are free to use it, but otherwise you have no influence. And how about if such companies could be forced to really act as a platform in a way to say, okay, you have your free offerings of using your service, but if you do so, you also have to provide, let's say, a paid platform service where people can build their own solution on top of your platform, on top of your messaging, on top of your web technology that you use in Facebook. And they could maybe be forced to do so by governments, or be open to that.
Thank you. Basically, it's a bit provocative question, but I like to ask, why just don't demand to nationalize tech giants or to create own alternative based on public, not private interest? I mean, regulation is a good issue, but it's not solved the problem of digital colonialism, like generally. It made digital colonialism softer, but still all data are collected by American companies, or if, as we see in case of the Telegram Messenger, it's formerly Russian app, but it used just Amazon or Google Clouds to provide all services, and basically in the end, we have American companies in charge. So, why just don't try to make it in other way?
Can I?
But just quickly on that. There was a talk after the Cambridge Analytica thing in the UK. A few people were proposing that let's nationalize Facebook, and my response was Facebook now brought to you by the people that brought you Brexit. So it scares the hell out of me. Sorry.
Sorry that we don't have time for the other questions, but I think all of us will stay after, so it will be great to continue the discussion after. I think we mentioned already, I think I brought it up myself, like why it was, or why I think it's a bad idea to nationalize Facebook. So it's like from moving from private control, this platform, towards bringing it into a nation state. And my colleague here was pinpointing the problems of nation states being with a huge control that provides them. In your question of the platform, I absolutely agree. Like, we really have to redefine the vocabulary that we use to this. I could rather call them tools of exploitation. So Facebook or social media could be a tool that, if we are so dependent, can become public infrastructure. But to call it a platform now as this kind of plain, neutral language scene doesn't really fit with the logic that it follows in exploiting data from users. Like, think that the whole logic of the business model of Facebook is not connecting people, but it's profit. It's extracting as much data as possible. And I think it was you who was like questioning like what we can do, or are we complicit in things? And let me just give you a very maybe dramatic example of what we are complicit of. So, like, I believe in the last month, majority of you have filled a CAPTCHA of Google to prove that you are not a robot, right? Or that's the narrative that is presented to us, that you recognize a few traffic signs, or if there is a human or a dog in an image, in order to prove that you are not a robot, so you can enter a website. What is actually happening is that we are training an image recognition system for Google. Google, a year ago, sold what they call the Project Maven, that is an artificial intelligence system of image recognition for the US drone program. So just think that every time that you are filling a CAPTCHA, we are all complicit of the killing of innocent citizens in plenty of countries that the US is using their drone program. So we are complicit until the point that we are just slave to this system of I'm not putting the blame on us. We are rather the victims of these systems. But unless we change it, we are fortifying and making stronger this system by giving our production of data for these actors that will use it. I think now we are all familiar with the topic of political manipulation and with Cambridge Analytica. By the way, just closed doors yesterday. Mm-hmm. Great news. I hope many more will follow. But also economic and, in this case, military exploitation. And I don't think that we are yet aware, every time we fill a CAPTCHA, of the implications of this action, of recognizing these images, for what kind of interest is going this labor to.
Well, I prefer the metaphors, because we are almost in the end. We need to remember who was the colonization and who was colon. We can talk about the discover of a new continent with no rules. Columbus, I'm sorry. A new continent with no rules. Or we can talk about the meet each other, you know, two different cultures with a lot of conflicts. But at the end, we are the sons of that people, of both of them. So I think that in the internet, there is not a lot of savage people, and then we need government and platform ruling all the internet like little squares, like you are, like this. Maybe we need to understand the freedom of the people, the humanity, the different ways of expressions, and you know, work with it, with that, not only control, not only take all the part of all the life. So maybe if we think in colonization like an opportunity to rediscover, to be different, maybe we can avoid a lot of conflicts, because we are in the frontier of a new big conflict. So
yeah. I think with refugee populations, there's so many exciting technological developments, like the World Food Programme uses blockchain and is experimenting with different ways to deliver services to people. And I think there's a confusion sometimes in those fields, who is the benefactor? So you have the organizations that are trying to provide a service more efficiently. Is the technology for them, or is it for the recipients of that service, whatever it may be? And I think there's some confusion there. And the thing about having diverse stakeholders in the development of the technology isn't just, you know, something you say. I mean, it really is, people have no awareness of what the risks are of engaging with these technologies in Western societies, let alone in societies of marginalized populations or refugee populations. So I think it's really important that people participate in the development and that we have a better awareness of it. Mm-hmm. With questions like nationalization, or, you know, why not make one part of Facebook that's like this and another that's like that? I mean, it sounds, those are the kinds of like far out questions we need to be asking. I think these companies didn't exist 10, 15 years ago, and it's crazy to think that their destiny is predetermined. Of course we can rethink, of course we can regulate, of course we can radically change the way that they operate, but it takes asking the questions and having this conversation and awareness about what is it we want to accomplish with this. And when you look at the movements for decolonization all over the world, it's about people rising, thing. It's about a whole different set of factors that need to happen at once. And unfortunately, with decolonization in political terms, we've also had, you know, governments that have been less than ideal, even when they weren't colonies. We've had all kinds of dictatorships and terrible outcomes in decolonization as well. So we need to be prepared for a constant battle, but to learn from the past, I guess.
Yeah. We've run out of time. Quick points. Blockchains, environmentally unfriendly. World Food Program, it's only one customer, so it's not a blockchain. The amazing question on digital labor. Shout out to Christian Fuchs. He's a Marxist scholar at the University of Westminster. He's been dealing with digital labor. It's amazing work, precisely. And thanks for Renata for bringing us together. I hope she's watching the video. And thanks very much.
Hi, Renata.
Great.